he has abolished the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Oh, Canada, you have been rejecting offers to join the United States for over 250 years. The First Continental Congress sent you a love letter in 1774 asking you to join the rebellion against the evil King George, but you declined. The Second Continental Congress sent you another love letter in 1775, and again you refused. Then the Founding Fathers thought maybe you needed some convincing at the tip of a bayonet. So in September 1775, they sent an army over the border to convince you to join the righteous struggle for freedom. But you refused once again. A final love letter was sent in 1776, and still there was only silence north of the border. In that silence, one could hear a clear message from Canadians. We would prefer to be subjects of King George than citizens of a new experimental republic. Fast forward 250 years, and the opinion north of the border is still strong and clear. Canadians still do not want to be part of the United States. The view south of the border is one of confusion. In fact, it is still difficult for many Americans to understand why a colony so similar to the 13 original colonies refused to join the rebellion in 1776 and still rejects offers of union to this very day. So, today we're going to take a deep dive into Canadian history and the Declaration of Independence. And here with me to explain the relationship between Canada and the 13 colonies is Mark R. Anderson. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Very much appreciate this opportunity to talk to your audience.
Mark is an independent historian in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He is a specialist in Canada, northern borderlands, and Native Americans in the American Revolutionary Era. He is the author of multiple articles, essays, and three books, including The Battle for the 14th Colony, America's War of Liberation in Canada, 1774 to 1776, published by the University Press of New England in 2013. So, Mark, you started by reading grievance number 20 from our numbered list of grievances. And in fact, what we see here is the mention of a neighboring province, and the neighboring province that Jefferson is referring to is, of course, Canada. But before we go more into detail into that grievance, we need to set the scene. So, Mark, can you please give us an overview of Canada before the Revolution, starting whenever you think is important?
Certainly. In terms of what we're talking about with Canada at the time in 1776, it's technically the province of Quebec, a much smaller thing than what we envision Canada today. It's roughly equivalent to the modern province of Quebec. But at the time, it was commonly referred to as Canada and had been the French colony of New France. Geography-wise, people tend not to be overly familiar with what Canada actually looks like. At the time, it was a settled string of towns and three cities on about a 200-mile stretch of the St. Lawrence River. The St. Lawrence River running northeast from the Great Lakes to dump out into the Atlantic, in the far North Atlantic, without a whole lot of connection to the colonies to the south. That string of settlement along the St. Lawrence River did have two tributaries coming in from the south, where there was some settlement up by Quebec City, which was the northernmost city. There's the Chaudière River, and down in the south, near Montreal, there's the Richelieu River. And this is going to be an important part of geography in that the Richelieu River is fed by Lake Champlain, which connects New York and its Hudson River Valley through a series of portages to Canada and the St. Lawrence River. And this had been the highway of trade and warfare for generations in North America. Until 1763, Canada had been a colony of New France, a separate entity from the English Protestant colonies to the south, and it had been the enemy, Catholic, French-speaking, different. Canada entered a new phase of imperial history with the French and Indian War, Seven Years' War, when Britain conquered New France in 1759 and 1760, imposed military rule, and then with the peace settlement, Canada was given to the British Empire. King George III issued his proclamation of 1763, which amongst many things that have been talked about in your previous episodes, defined colonial boundaries and a concept for how these new colonies, Canada included, would be incorporated into the empire. It set the path for transition from military to civil government for Canada. Specifically, it talked about having government by provincial assembly, applying British law, and having British concepts of property holding. Demographically, by the time of the Revolution, there's some more key terms that we need to keep in mind here. There were generally two groups of the population. They talked to them as old subjects, which were Anglo-Protestants who had been subjects of the king before the conquest. And there were the new subjects, the French, Catholic, Canadians, who had been incorporated after the conquest. They also generally referred to them as English or French at the time, even though they're all Canadians living in Canada. Numbers-wise, there's a fairly small population in Canada, about 110,000 people by the best estimate. Compare that with a colony like Connecticut that had 200,000. Of the 110,000 at the Revolution, estimates are that perhaps 2,000 of those were the old subject English Protestant subjects who had moved in after the conquest in 1760. The other 108,000-ish being the French Catholic Canadians. Geography and politics helped define the information environment in Canada. Quebec City, up in the northeast, was the gateway to the Atlantic world for the province. On the other end, Montreal was the gateway to the fur trade. Quebec City had the only printing press in the entire colony, and it served as a government printer. So it was going to be a loyal form of communication. Amongst the three urban centers, Montreal, Quebec City, and a very small city in between, Three Rivers, there were coffee houses and taverns that provided for merchant information exchange. But throughout most of the province, the primary means of information exchange was the rural parish priests who received the Quebec Gazette to receive official proclamations and could communicate other information from across the world that came through those means. But there was also a growing role for grain traders that were popping up in the rural communities who were gathering wheat that was then being sold into the transatlantic economy. Canada had always been a dependent colony, never self-sufficient economically, reliant on external manufacturers and externally funded government. The Indian fur trade had been the anchor of the economy, but as I mentioned, this wheat trade was growing. It needed links to the Atlantic world to flourish. With the demographics, internal politics quickly post-conquest split into two parties. There was the British Party, which consisted of the Anglo-Protestant new settlers, but old subjects, who expected government would deliver on the proclamation of 1763, making them a dominant minority because they were Protestant and would bring about an assembly and English landholding practices. In opposition was the French Party, the vast majority of the province, and particularly the upper-class Canadians, their nobility, who sought to restore the kind of power that they had had in the French colony, recognizing the reality on the ground that they should be represented in whatever form of government because they were the vast majority of the people. And the Catholic Church was a key player in this. With the conquest, the British had helped influence the selection of a new bishop for Canada because the previous bishop had died during the French and Indian War of natural causes. So with British influence, negotiations behind the scenes with London, Paris, and Rome, Bishop Jean-Olivier Briand had been selected as the bishop. And there was tacit recognition by him that he needed to help support the British government, and the British government recognized that he was an important influence as well. So Canada was set on a course to remain distinctly different from the other British North American colonies from 1763 to 1775. Just a few years after the proclamation of 1763, however, it became clear that Quebec was not going to become a Protestant English-speaking province, despite whatever the proclamation might have envisioned. So Quebec's second governor, Guy Carleton, adapted to the reality on the ground. He began facilitating French colonial tradition in law, landholding, the Catholic Church, and incorporating French Canadian nobility as much as he could legally do. And then in the 1770s, he travels to London to try to encapsulate this in law to make an enlightened vision of what Canada might be and how this different foreign French Canadian French Catholic population could be incorporated into the empire. And the result of that is the Quebec Act of 1774.
And I want to jump in here because I just think we need to talk a little bit about some of the key points that will keep following us. You mentioned some of the profound differences. Many of us, let's say Americans today, going to Canada, maybe not to the French-speaking parts, but think of Canada as being pretty similar to the U.S. But you're saying from its roots that it's markedly different, and you identified a couple of key factors. Obviously, they had a French culture. They were French, and they were Catholic. And being French and Catholic leads to two, I would argue, strands of separateness or difference that are pretty difficult to paper over. And one is the Catholicism issue, which again has an institutionalized hierarchy and this priest class that controls information, as you said. And I thought it was remarkable that at the time Canada only had one printing press, which is quite interesting and has some ramifications for the spread of political ideas. Because in the 13 other colonies, of course, there are lots of printing presses, and one might argue the population was much more political. Do you have anything to say about that?
I would say that that is true. The printing press definitely is a factor, but there's still this flow of newspapers from the Atlantic world. So where there are the Anglo-Protestant merchants, there is this flow of information, and there's exchange with the French Canadian population, but they do have different perspectives. Going back to, say, the Stamp Act Congress or Stamp Act crisis, there is some discussion, heated debates about how that affects Canada, but I think there's less, as you talked about, there's less political heat other than key events like that because they're focused on other things. They're still trying to figure out how they're going to rule this new colony, rather than worrying about their relationship so much with the rest of the empire and traditional British rights.
And what about the Catholicism versus Protestant traditions? How we might see those differences sort of revealing some other profound differences between Canadian and American colonial traditions?
It's certainly,
I'm thinking again, going back to the printing press, the Protestant belief that one ought to read the Bible oneself, right? So one ought to be literate so one can read the Bible oneself versus the Catholic tradition, which now, of course, Catholics should read the Bible, but we're all literate now. But back then, the priest was interpreting the Bible for you. You didn't necessarily need a personal relationship with God. You needed a relationship with the Catholic hierarchy.
That is very true. French Canadian literacy was fairly low compared to their neighbors to the south, and Catholic Church, very hierarchical. But in Canada, just the expanse created a somewhat different, more independent environment. All of the things that you said are true, but the nature of Canada did moderate that a bit. But as we talked about, the parish church, the parish priest are sort of the center of information flow outside of the cities. And they're going to prove to be a moderating influence in many aspects.
Okay, good. Maybe you can just talk a little bit more about the economic situation. So you mentioned once the fur trade and then the wheat trade. Can you just gloss that a little bit more? Maybe talk about the importance of those two trades for the development of Canada.
So economically, the fur trade had been the reason that Canada had really been populated at all. Trade with the Indians, bringing European products over, French products during the pre-conquest era and then a replacement with English products after the conquest, creating those transatlantic connections and providing goods deep into the American heartland, the Great Lakes, and in return getting the furs back to France, then England. And then as Canadians, farmers move beyond basic subsistence and have surplus, there starts to be this transatlantic wheat trade as well. But with mercantilist policies, all this funnels through the metropolitan ports or within the empire. So there's this a vast trade as well going on after the conquest, not just with London, but also with the other colonies and the Caribbean, that provides means of exchange and economically starts to bring Canada into the British economy. But because of the geography, it's very different from the other colonies where they can communicate across short distances.
And maybe one last word on the economy. Unlike, say, the southern colonies in the U.S., was there no slavery at all? Was slavery banned, or just was it not practice, or was it just a minimal practice in Canada?
In Canada, there was limited slavery, heavily from indigenous slaves, but with some black slaves as well. But they were not a key element of the economy. They were primarily domestic servants for the French Canadian nobility, and some of the Anglo-Protestant newcomers brought them with them as well. But primarily it was a French nobility measure of prosperity, a way to show your wealth.
So it wasn't key to their economy.
That's correct.
Okay, good. So we have these two vastly different colonies. We have this old French, now a new colony. It's become British. It's still obviously heavily French. And you have is Guy Carleton the governor of Quebec?
That is correct.
So Guy Carleton is the new governor, and he goes to London to figure out how to start basically melding these two separate traditions. You have the Catholic French tradition, which is the dominant tradition, and then you have the new Anglo-Protestant tradition. And what we need to do is construct, say, some sort of single identity out of this. So pick up the story again, please, with Guy Carleton.
So Guy Carleton had gone to London and spent many months there working with the ministry, trying to figure out how to codify a new relationship with French Canadians. Because by traditional English lowercase c constitution, a Catholic cannot serve in a government office. And there had been these promises from the proclamation that they would have an assembly. But Canada never had enough money to provide its own government, so it was being subsidized. The assembly would not be figuring out where their own money went. They didn't have their own money to run their own government. So all these things are part of what Guy Carleton is working on. And he's really just trying to align law and a new vision for a constitution with the reality in the colony. And what ends up creating is the Quebec Act of 1774. We'll talk about the timing perhaps in a minute. But what this the Quebec Act does is it creates an appointed council versus an elected assembly. It recognizes the Catholic religion and restores the rights of the Catholic Church amongst Catholics. It recognizes the landholding class, the seigneury or the seigneurs, and their rights to hold land and then rent out to the farmers, which had been the traditional French way of landholding. It removes the test oath, which required recognizing King George as the head of the church, which was an issue from having French Canadian office holders. It established French civil law as opposed to criminal law. They did still have English criminal law. But in effect, what it did was ensure that the Anglo-Protestant minority didn't dictate law for the vast majority of the province. It also tightened church and nobility ties to the imperial government, not just because there was brewing unrest in the colonies, but for the future of the empire. The cons of the Quebec Act were that the British party saw this as an attack on all their expectations, the reasons that they had moved to Canada. They expected to have an assembly. They expected that they would be a powerful minority. So they protest the act and its conflict with both proclamation and British traditions and start petitioning for its repeal. There's also an impact on the habitant farmers in that since the conquest, there had been no legal enforcement of church tithes or their rents to their landholding seigneurs. So application varied across the province, but now with the Quebec Act, there was going to be legal backing to the requirement to make these payments for them. So in the coming months, there will be some effect of that as well. And the Quebec Act has a tremendous influence in the other colonies, the 13 colonies, because I alluded to the timing earlier. Guy Carleton had been working on this for many months, but the final version of the Quebec Act gets completed early in 1774, shortly after the Boston Tea Party really triggers the chain of events that are going to lead to the Revolutionary War. It gets assented to by the king in June of 1774. So it's going to go into law on May 1st, 1775. So between its being approved, we have the First Continental Congress is going to meet in the fall of 1774, and then the Quebec Act is going to go into effect May 1775, as we will see that everything starts to unravel in North America. The other colonies see the timing as intentional, not coincidental. So it is grouped with the other coercive acts, even though it's not part of the coercive act package, to be one of the intolerable acts. Catholicism and its recognition is a huge issue, as we saw in that description of absolute government and different practices in the reference in the Declaration. Tyrannical government with no assembly and the extension of boundaries is also a key issue, because many of the key leaders amongst the 13 colonies have property interests in the Ohio Valley. The Quebec Act expands the boundaries of Quebec to include everything north of the Ohio River, which is an expansive area where these people have investments, and they had fought the French and Indian War.
I think including Washington and Franklin.
Yes.
To name two.
And the colonies had fought in the French and Indian War in part to ensure their access to these lands in the contest between the French and the British empires. And now they're being cut off by this extension of Quebec and arbitrary government and Catholicism being imposed in that region.
This is such an interesting story because it kind of throws everything on its head. One would think that it would be the original French people who might have sided with becoming independent from King George and who maybe would not have liked the Quebec Act. But in fact, it's the other way around. It's the Anglo-Protestants that are angry at their own Anglo-Protestant king and head of state and head of church who are the ones that are pissed off by what King George has done. I just think it's a funny twist of history that the Quebec Act sort of alienated the wrong people, historically speaking.
And the Quebec Act starts anger and accusations against the king that hadn't existed before. Focus up to 1774 and the Quebec Act had really been against Parliament and the British ministry, with the view that the king was being kept from the facts in North America and that he might intervene and solve these problems. But with the Quebec Act, he is violating his oath that he has taken as king to have Protestant church. So in the very religious focused views of the world at the time, Americans start to see that maybe the king is part of the problem as well.
Yeah, and it's funny, reading this grievance again for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, which is good, which we like, the free system of English laws, unlike the system of bondage that the French Catholic system was, you know. Establishing therein an arbitrary government, again, not representative of the people with local assemblies. So unlike our system, but like the hated French one. And then you mentioned, and enlarging its boundaries, taking away the land that we thought we fought for in the French and Indian War. And lastly, a fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies. Again, absolute rule with its overtones of French monarchy and also papal Roman Catholic hierarchy. But what's hysterical about this passage for me in the Declaration is the words French and Catholic are never actually mentioned, nor is Quebec. So you just have to kind of know what's going on to understand the context there. And we discussed previously in previous episodes, of course, that Washington and Jefferson did not want to alienate Catholics, their own American Catholics, say, in Maryland. And anyway, this is what, just a wonderful gloss on this great passage. Anyway, let's move on now to our next major topic, which is the Continental Congress and the first attempt by the Founding Fathers to try to get Canada on the side of the rebellion.
So in the fall of 1774, before the war has kicked off, First Continental Congress meets in Philadelphia, and they're really meeting for political purposes. Independence is certainly not in the air, and there's an intention to try to solve the problems politically, develop new ways to keep the American colonies in the empire, but solve the problems that the Patriot leaders see have developed ever since the French and Indian War. Part of what the First Continental Congress does is send messages out to the British Atlantic world. The most important thing that the First Continental Congress does, however, is create the Continental Association, a non-import, non-export agreement that's economically going to try to make their point with London and the British ministry. But they're also working on these messages to communicate why they're doing what they're doing and how it's going to impact other parts of the empire, including Britain, the other colonies. But they create a specific message for the province of Quebec, their letter to the inhabitants of Quebec. And this happens to be the last message that they send before they adjourn and break up the First Continental Congress. It's the longest, most specific of these many messages that they're sending out, 18 pages of messaging that sets the tone for relations with Canada throughout the course of the American Revolution. John Dickinson, who was the penman of the Revolution, who had written letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania, actually comes in to help write this document. And he puts together a fabulous Enlightenment message that perhaps isn't really the right message for the French Canadians who have Catholic French traditions, as opposed to Enlightenment views that the American leaders in the 13 colonies have at the time. But he's trying to be generous. Starts with addressing the Canadians as friends and fellow subjects, and praising Canada as a truly valuable addition to the empire. He addressed the most important contentious issue head-on, religion. He suggested ways that Catholics could be accommodated in what the 13 colonies was an anti-Catholic society. He offered the Swiss Federation as an example where there could be Catholic cantons and Protestant cantons all working together. And whereas the Quebec Act had given religious rights to the Catholics, he argued that liberty of conscience was really God-given, not something that the king could give. But that was sort of a specious argument. And then he goes on to provide a primer on British political tradition, describing five essential rights, the reasons why Canada, with the Quebec Act, was under an absolute government. These five rights were representative government, trial by jury, habeas corpus, landholding, and freedom of the press. And the Congress letter explained that these are the rights without which a people cannot be free and happy. And these were the rights that the ministry was striving to take away by force of arms. In conclusion, this letter said that Canada was, quote, the only link wanting to complete the bright and shining chain of union in North America. It must be remembered, this was in political opposition to Parliament and the ministry. Their goal of cooperation was, according to the letter, the perfect security of the natural and civil rights of all the constituent members and the preservation of a happy and lasting connection with Great Britain. went on to suggest that the inhabitants of Quebec should meet together in your several towns and districts and elect deputies, who could then, in turn, choose delegates to send to the Second Continental Congress that was going to meet in May 1775. This was a unique opportunity offered to Quebec that had not been offered to any of the other colonies, besides the original 13, to join the Confederated colonies. And it set the tone for relations with Canada. It was friendly, inviting, if a little patronizing. And Congress, recognizing the information challenges, translated it and had it printed in French. It took a while for that to happen. So copies of the letter reached Canada, and they're actually hand manuscripts written with a local translation started to be distributed before the official translated version ever got to Canada. So the message did get there in the course of a couple months.
Yeah, and just pause there. There's no receiver address, because there is no one to send this letter to. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I mean, so that's just like, well, this is the message we want to send to the people of Canada, and then it's just send it out there. But you don't, like, send it to another government official or some counterpart. There is no counterpart to send it to.
That is correct. What ends up happening, and what was probably the goal, is these old subject Anglo-Protestant members of the British party in Canada have a lot of common ground, and there's communication going on. So they expect that that's where the seed will be planted and then spread around.
Oh, okay, so maybe that there were some addressees, and that would be members of the new settlers, the old subjects, then, the members of the British party there.
That would be the post office box, if you will, for where it would arrive and then be spread out.
Right. The other thing I think is interesting about how you described that letter is, you know, the explaining to people who probably thought they were plenty free enough that they weren't free enough.
Yes.
The five reasons why they were oppressed and didn't realize it, which just seems quite humorous.
Yes. You thought you were happy, but here's the reasons why you should not be happy.
Funny. Okay, Mark, and any last comments you'd like to make on that first letter to the inhabitants of Canada and the Quebec Act?
So when the letter arrives in Canada, I mentioned that there were, even before the official one arrives, there's handwritten translations that start getting spread around. Here again, the printing press limitation comes into fact. The government printer is not going to be distributing these. So it's a homespun version of a network that spreads these around, and it starts to spark conversations that make British government officials uncomfortable. Historically, loyalist British Canadian historians have liked to look back on one event where it talks about, they compare the letter to the inhabitants of Quebec with a different version, a different letter from the First Continental Congress that went to London that mentions all the horrible things that the French Catholic Canadians have done in the past, which sparks some outrage. But that, in my observation of the overall picture, was a minor incident in an urban center as opposed to its influence across the province. And I really think it really sparked conversations and perhaps starts bringing in the rural French-Canadian inhabitants' alignment with the old subject Anglo-Protestant merchants in the cities as they communicate that they might have some common interests. Canadian committees start standing up on a more formal basis in Montreal and Quebec City, still anchored on their opposition to the Quebec Act, but communicating with the other colonies. And then the Boston Committee of Correspondence sends a messenger, spy, depending on what perspective you have, to Canada in the spring of 1775, before Lexington and Concord, and he meets with the Montreal Committee. What he finds is, although the British party is agitated by the Quebec Act, they are not ready to commit to representation in the Continental Congress. Even the most radical and outspoken Canadians cannot commit to joining the Continental Association, which is the threshold for joining the Continental Congress. The economic realities in Canada, non-import, non-export acts, just are not supportable with their economy. So they don't send a formal delegation, but one of their members, James Price, does unofficially travel to Philadelphia after the Second Continental Congress convenes and shares this reality, as well as James Brown, the messenger from the Boston Committee that had gone up there. He brings it back as well. So Continental Congress is aware, at least, that this there's this gap.
So if the intent of the letter was to kickstart a political process, that didn't quite happen in the way that they wanted it to, at least the way the founders wanted it to.
That is correct.
Okay, good. Well, let's move on then. We're coming up to a very turbulent summer of 1775 now. So how do we continue the story, Mark?
So we have this communication starting between the colonies and the Canadian committees, but there's all these other things going on. The Quebec Act is going to go into effect on May 1st. That's just a couple weeks after Lexington and Concord. And it's going to cause its own Canadian unrest. British Party and French Party leaders or agitators have fist fights in Montreal over the Quebec Act, sparked by an act of vandalism against the bust of King George that's in one of the meeting places in Montreal. So it's inflaming tensions, coincident, but not driven by what's going on in the colonies to the south. Within, again, weeks, Patriot rebels have taken Fort Ticonderoga and Crown Point, which are the key forts at the south end of Lake Champlain in the colonial bounds of New York, but on that highway, that water highway that leads into Canada. And then on May 18th, so 18 days into the Quebec Act, Patriot rebels make raids on the British fort at Fort St. John's on the Canadian side of the border to seize a British ship that is there and take it into the Continental Service and secure their control of Lake Champlain. But of course, Canadians, those loyal to the government, see this as a violation, an attack on the Canadians. So it sparks loyalist responses as they go, particularly French Canadian nobility and prominent British loyalists go to Fort St. John's to help supplement the very small British regular military force there and help prepare to defend the province from these rebels in the future. I talked about James Price had gone to Congress and John Brown, the Boston committee representative, had come back to Philadelphia and shared the Montreal committee's perspectives. This prompts a second letter from Congress that you talked about in the introduction. It addresses two major issues that have happened since this first letter. The first is it refers to the Quebec Act.
And I'm just going to butt in here. Yep. Let's note the important change in the title of this letter. The first letter was called To the Inhabitants of Quebec. The second letter is called To the Oppressed Inhabitants of Quebec, which is an important change.
Yes. And the first thing that it talks about, the first big issue it tackles is the Quebec Act going into effect. And it says, "We most sincerely condole with you on the arrival of that day, in the course of which the sun could not shine on a single freeman in all your extensive dominion." So recognizing that this arbitrary government has now been imposed on them. But it also addresses the military developments, the fact that the war has kicked off, the fact that the forts have been taken at the south end of Lake Champlain, and that there have been these raids into Canada. Second Continental Congress explains that we are your friends, not your enemies, and be not imposed upon by those who may endeavor to create animosities between them. They say that the taking of the forts was dictated by the great law of self-preservation and reassured the Canadians that you may rely on our assurances that these colonies will pursue no measures whatever, but such as friendship and a regard for our mutual safety and interests may suggest. As we've already, you know, alluded to the fact that there's going to be an invasion, these sound hollow, but given the situation at the time, it expressed Continental Congress's early hesitation. They did not want to spark further war or shake the Canadians at this point in time. But things are going to happen elsewhere and in the northern borderlands in the summer of 1775. They're going to sort of change the tone of that. The American forces at Fort Ticonderoga and Crown Point on the south end of Lake Champlain send scouting missions up into Canada, and reports of these spark Governor Guy Carleton to declare martial law to protect the loyalty of his province on June 9th, 1775. This creates its own discontent in Canada. So we've got the Quebec Act tensions and the martial law tensions fueling a fire in Canada, its own separate sort of unrest. The church, as might be expected, Bishop Briand, his vicar generals, and parish priests are strong advocates for the British government, as opposed to this unrest that's going on in the South. The bishop sends out a letter to be distributed to all the churches that tells his people not to listen to the seditious people, to have a sense of submission to legitimate superiors, referring, as Thomas Kidd talked about in that previous episode, about the reference specifically in Romans in the Bible, that the powers that be are ordained of God. Mm-hmm. And so the parish priests take a particularly political stance in these brewing tensions, and that is unpopular in some of the parishes, which leads to outspoken opposition, people even standing up in church and shouting down their priests. And the response to that is a threat to deny sacraments to anybody who does that. So we have this church tension. We have Governor Carleton reinstating the militia that had not existed for 10 years in Canada to try to defend the province. And this is unpopular across much of the province. There's support by the French-Canadian nobility because this restores them to the position they had had under the French. But individual Canadian farmers, the ones who are even called to form up, aren't happy with this. Many of them feel that martial law is unjustified. They haven't really been invaded. It doesn't affect them out in the hinterland. And Carleton chooses to appoint militia captains instead of the French-Canadian tradition of electing locally who their militia captain will be and having that recognized by the governor. So what happens is the landholding seigneurs, in some cases, go out to try to mobilize the militia, and in three different incidents, they're actually met with armed opposition, essentially forced to go back home rather than being able to mobilize their militia. So there's this element of what's going on as well, along with correspondence that's happening between patriot rebels and like-minded Canadians discussing how an invasion might actually help the situation in Canada. If the Canadians are being impressed by the British government, perhaps the Americans coming in could remove that and let the Canadians express their true feelings. And, you know, as would be expected, then they would logically join the other colonies.
Okay, so just a quick comment there. What was the reason that the sort of normal Canadian was refusing to join the militia?
So the regular farmers didn't necessarily feel that there was any reason for the militia to be mobilized, and it was an obligation to them. It took them away from their farms, and it recognized authority that they didn't feel was right, in that these militia captains had been appointed by the governor instead of being chosen by themselves in elections, as had been their traditional practice.
But they didn't consider whatever was happening on the border threat then?
They didn't feel that warranted a militia mobilization.
Okay. They thought that the British regular army should do its job.
Yeah, the British regular army was doing its job, and there was no need for them to be pulled away from their farms, listen to people that they didn't necessarily respect, even though they were their landholders, and they wanted to do things there the way that they had done. So a conservative movement from the lower classes, as opposed to the conservative movement amongst the upper French Canadian classes that wanted to be restored to their positions of power.
Terrific. Thank you, Mark. We'll end here as the Continental Congress is deciding what to do about its northern neighbors. In the next episode, we'll discuss the invasion of Canada, as well as the third and final letter to the inhabitants of Canada. Thanks for listening.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty. Liberty, the pursuit.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.